crime fiction can often be read as a kind of travelogue because it reveals a lot about life in a particular place and time. Think of Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles, Henning Mankell's Sweden, Alexander McCall Smith's Botswana, Ruth Rendell's London, or Donna Leon's Venice. Lately, New York City has become a favorite setting for thrillers, and each one seems to focus on a different aspect of the city. Back in August, I spoke to three crime writers about New York as the setting for their books: Lee Child, whose latest is Gone Tomorrow; George Dawes Green, his recent novel is Ravens; and Reggie Nadelson, whose latest book is Londongrad. Listeners told us that they liked our conversation a lot, and we thought that we would rebroadcast it today. Lee Child is the current president of the Mystery Writers of America, and I asked him, how many of your members are New Yorkers?
A lot of them, actually. Mystery Writers of America has regional chapters, and the New York regional chapter is the largest, I'm sure. And, yeah, there's dozens of us here.
So I guess that's always been, although the people I mentioned earlier were more connected with the places that they wrote about.
Yeah, I'm not sure that New York anymore has that really strong regional connection with crime writing in the way that Los Angeles was for Raymond Chandler, for instance. I think that possibly that's something that belongs more to the past. New York has changed, I think, in terms of crime. It's relatively crime-free.
Right. You have to set
it's
all
hard.
Your books.
It's hard to find a crime these days.
You have to set your books in the 70s, don't you?
Yeah,
you do.
I mean, that's a huge contrast, obviously. I mean, for me in Gone Tomorrow, the thing, I needed a subway, and New York has obviously got the finest subway, and really, it's really the only American city where you just reflexively go on the subway. You know, D.C. has one, but it's a little more limited, and it's
San Francisco has a very limited.
Yeah, one. Chicago has the L, but New York is the subway is absolutely part of the city. And aside from that, I found the anonymity of New York to be the key characteristic for that book, not crime at all. I mean, I feel you walk around New York now; it's a very benevolent, peaceful place.
Well, could you have said it in London, where the underground is as important to life as our subway system is?
Yeah, London would have worked if it had been a European book, maybe Paris, but in America, it had to be New York.
Reggie, your books are mostly set in New York and often revolve around the Russian immigrant community in Brighton Beach. How did you come to be interested in this particular neighborhood?
Well, I actually grew up around here. I grew up in Greenwich Village, and I've lived in New York all my life. What got me interested in it was actually that when I was working as a journalist, I spent a lot of time in the former Soviet Union, and I was really lucky because I got there in 1987. It was the first time in my life where you could see history happening. I mean, one week there'd be nothing. The next week there'd be six rock concerts. The fourth week there'd be six guys who were rock gurus, and it was just absolutely gripping. And also for a red diaper baby like me, who grew up in a kind of very left-wing New York atmosphere, to suddenly be in this place. And I kept meeting characters who were absolutely astonishing, and that led me to Brighton Beach.
But then you also write about other parts of Brooklyn, like Red Hook, Sheepshead Bay, Coney Island.
Well, once I started, I mean, of course, my ancestors came from Brooklyn, meaning my parents and my aunts and uncles. And I realized that Brooklyn has now what Manhattan, in a way, no longer has. It has that.
All the writers.
It has all the writers. It has the textures of when we were growing up. It has, you know, what I remember as an infant being taken to Brooklyn Dodgers games. And then once I'd done stuff with Brighton Beach, I started thinking, the thing that got to me was I'd never really clocked that New York is an archipelago, that it's a city on water, like Hong Kong, like Bombay, and all these bits and islands. And I'd never been to Red Hook in my life. Who goes to Red Hook? And I wrote one set on, you live there, you're lucky. I even set one on Staten Island, which I'd never been to.
George, your latest novel isn't set in New York, but in your native Georgia, but that means you're returning home after your first two, The Caveman's Valentine and The Juror, which recently was reissued, right? They were both set in New York.
Yeah, and I was writing about New York in the mid-90s, which was, to me, or particularly the early 90s, was the apogee of New York crime and wildness. The problem with New York now is that it's become such a sweet city. It's become a city. You know,
we can't get the federal government to give us extra money for our police department.
Well, that should help. I'm sure that things will change. New York is not going to remain this crime, you know, relatively crime-free place for very long. But it's amazing that when I, you know, when you want to explore loneliness and alienation, I needed to go back home for this most recent book, because New York is now this, you know, it's a great community, and it's you know, we all know that we can walk the streets now without getting mugged. The subways are not nearly as dangerous. There just isn't as much rich material as there was when I wrote The Caveman's Valentine.
Aren't you the founder of the storytelling series The Moth?
I am.
So,
speaking of community.
Well, I was wondering about whether people are finding interesting New York stories to tell anymore.
Well, no, people, I mean, there's so many stories to tell, but crime, there's a lot less crime. And when people, you know, it's so interesting. We just had a night of thriller stories at The Moth, and people reached back, for the most part, into the early 90s. Who was that guy in Greenwich Village who cut up women and ate them? Do you remember that cannibal, the cannibal of the East Village? I can't remember his name.
I thought they were most of the people
I knew. Was it Daniel? I'm told, but Daniel Rakowicz was it?
That's right, that's right. But that was like, you know, that was 20 years ago. And he, I understand that he's
We had to compete with Jeffrey Dahmer in Cincinnati, I think.
Yeah.
I know. But don't you think, though, in some way, I mean, with Lee's book, this takes place on the 6 train, which is my train, which happens to be the cleanest, nicest train. It's the only train where everybody's reading The New Yorker if they're not reading Henry James. I mean, it's, you know, like the uptown East Side train. But I thought, in a way, what's interesting about there not being so much outright crime, that in a way it's opened the door for a lot of us to do more interesting things. I mean, things that, in a sense, the Chandler's film noir, all of that was really about cracking open the moral universe as much as people, you know, eating people or having serial killers. And that's what I love about a lot of the books now. I don't think you could set it in London because the underground is so disgusting.
Well, there's also that other side. Hitchcock used to say that it's scarier to have somebody killed in a sunny kitchen than in a dark alley. And maybe that's what's happening with New York. And Lee, you have 13 novels in your Jack Reacher series set in different places, mm-hmm. but a couple are in New York. So how do you determine where and when?
It really just depends on what is the feel necessary for the book. You know, it's what a composer would call the key. You know, is this book in E-flat minor or is it in C major? That key feel will dictate the place. And I guess out of the 13, probably 4 or 5 of them have at least partially been in New York, because Reacher is a wanderer. And
a drifter, actually.
A drifter, yeah. And in the beginning of this book, Gone Tomorrow, he actually says he considers himself a citizen of the world and New York the capital of the world. And so it is kind of natural that he would be here from time to time, at least passing through.
When you were writing those books, were you seeing the city through his eyes?
Yeah, I mean, because his eyes are my eyes, in as much as obviously I was born in a little east of New York, actually about 3,000 miles east of New York. And so I came here as a visitor, the same as he does. And so I see what he sees. And over the 14 years that I've been doing this, New York has changed a little bit. As we were saying, it feels like a different city. The crime now, the crime doesn't happen when you step out of the bank. The crime happens while you're in the bank. You know, the Wall Street stories are going to be the next big thing. I think that's something coming. NYPD itself is a huge attraction, I think, to us, because whereas LAPD, Los Angeles, it's a kind of rather monolithic story. LAPD are bad. You know, they're all sort of corrupt or whatever. NYPD is an interesting case at the moment. They are the largest police department in America, probably the most advanced. They have tremendous foreign intelligence, which is something that I wasn't really very aware of. NYPD specifically has agents overseas because they need to know stuff and they can't wait for CIA to tell them. So there's a lot going on with the positive aspects. You know, the fact that you're not going to get mugged on a filthy street anymore in New York is not the end of the story by any means.
My guests are Lee Child, Reggie Nadelson, and also George Dawes Green, and we're talking about mystery novels set in New York City. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. All of you are detectives, all three of you are outsiders in the city in some way or another. Does that enable them and you to see the city with fresh eyes, George?
Yeah, I can say that Romulus Ledbetter, who was in my in Caveman's Valentine, is a schizophrenic who lives in a cave up in Inwood Park. So he's not a real detective, but he does have Southern roots, and particularly
a paranoid schizophrenic. Well, yeah. I associate that with Georgia.
I associate it with Inwood Park.
But he comes up, you know, after he takes a trip down south and comes back to the city, he sees it with new eyes. What I find interesting is that what you were saying earlier, Lee, about the richness of New York and the richness for crime writers not having yet been plumbed, I thought was evident in Richard Price's new book, Lush Life, where he goes to that neighborhood in the Lower East Side and looks at a neighborhood where everyone is saying, you know, this neighborhood has become bland now. And all of the old community is gone. There's nothing interesting. There's no more story. And Richard Price went there and found this incredibly compelling story about the yuppies who were pouring into the Lower East Side. So, yeah, it's always, you know, this rich New York tapestry is always producing.
And Lee mentioned Wall Street. Well, Colin Harrison's last book was about people who are involved in stock manipulation, among other things. Reggie, your hero, Artie Cohn, is a Russian-born NYPD detective who gets called in on cases involving the Russian community, which is a pretty closed society.
Well, unlike Lee, I mean, if Lee's hero is a kind of citizen of the world and a wanderer and a kind of slightly Clint Eastwood man with no name, my hero, Artie Cohn, just wants to be in New York. He wants to settle down and be, he doesn't care. It's a bit like my mother who fled Winnipeg when she was 17. She said, the only thing I care about is being in New York. And of course, he had a rotten time in the former Soviet Union. They left when he was 16. His father was thrown out of the KGB. His mother was a refusenik. And he finally got here and he thought, even though he's very educated, what can I do that's really New York? I'll become a cop. He doesn't want to go back. He doesn't want to speak the language. He wants to be here, preferably in downtown Manhattan. And of course, with every case, he gets sucked back into this community. He speaks the languages. He picks up a sidekick who is a larger-than-life Russian. And I think it's true. I think what George was saying, you know, there is no end, in a sense, to communities. I loved Richard Price's Lush Life for just that reason. My father grew up in that neighborhood.
To some degree, your approach reminds me of Tony Hillman's very different kind of setting, but again, somebody who has an insight or has detectives who have an insight into a closed society. The rest of us kind of see but don't really understand.
Well, that's been fun for me, too, because I'd done a lot of work in Russia. But, of course, I was born here. I was born up the street from here. So I grew up also in a strangely enclosed downtown Manhattan left-wing culture, which had its own rules in it, but which in some ways connect, of course, to Artie's father having been a communist in the KGB. So it's fun to wrap it all up together. But there's never going to be an end to stories in New York. I mean, you know, and the other thing is you have to defend yourself. Now my thing is, you know, everybody goes, oh my God, it's over. Soho's over. The East Village is over. The meat market is over. And I'm like, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s, people were terrified that New York would drown in horse. I think I have to say manure on this program. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing, the coming of the yuppies, the coming of the foreigners, the coming of the developers. That's what New York is.
Well, as safe as New York has felt, we still have had problems like terrorist attack. And Lee, you have a possible suicide bomber on the 6 train, the 6 train that Reggie says is where everybody's reading Henry James.
Uh-huh. And that was the start of the book where, because it is the world's greatest city and this stuff has to be taken seriously, and Reacher sees a woman on the 6 train and everything about his training tells him this is a suicide bomber. But simultaneously he's thinking, she can't be. This is ridiculous. It's the wrong time of day and it's the wrong place. But he has to do something about it because that's what you're obliged to do in this kind of a city. And the story takes off from there. And New York becomes the backdrop to the action rather than necessarily a participant, although I like the rather obvious imagery of the subway rumbling beneath the city as a kind of metaphor for what goes on beneath the city, because this is a very anonymous place. That's what I was trying to bring out in the book, was that Reacher really needs a wilderness frontier feel to work. And obviously you can get that way out west on the literal frontier, but New York is the same. The density of population is ultimately the same thing as complete loneliness. And these things can happen undetected in a city of this size and complexity.
Well, in your case, the city, it's the anonymity, but I suspect for George and Reggie, the setting automatically becomes an important element in your story.
I was just going to ask George, how did you get Inwood Park? Because that's where we were taken as kids to look for Indian heads. It was the big school outing. What made you use Inwood Park?
Well, Inwood Park actually has these Indian caves, and there was a man who died there, James Jarvis, who was a paranoid schizophrenic. And when I was reading about him in the New York Times, I began to think that a character like this could make a fabulous detective, probably a challenging detective, probably a difficult detective, since paranoid schizophrenics usually aren't good at reasoning processes. But then I did, you know, once you're working with New York City, you fall in love with this locale. It's so rich, and the great richness of New York to me is always this constant seeking for status from all directions. You know, you remember in Taxi Driver when the whole story is about people who are aware of stars around them, and all New York City is always aware that there are these great international global stars in their presence.
And we have to be cool when we see them.
And we have to be
cool. We have to be cool, but I think I read a piece in New York Magazine that said the most stressful thing, I guess, for professional classes in New York City, it's not the overwork, it's not the schools, it's not getting a bigger apartment. It's the gap between where you're at and where you see people like you at. It's the gap between desire and status. Yeah. And so you go, okay, that's not bad. I got my book published, but why can't it be number one on the bestseller? Okay, it's number one on the bestseller, but when am I going to win the Nobel Prize? Because now I'm not a crime writer. I've gone transcended my genre, as we all know certain people feel they have.
And it's doubly difficult in New York because it's actually quite hard to display outward signs of status, because we all live in small places because there really aren't any big places, and very few of us have cars, and so you can't get a huge house with three BMWs on the driveway. That sort of outlet is not open to you. So this constant display of status in ways that are severely limited is difficult for a lot of people.
I also think that the status thing, I was fascinated about your idea about the New York City Police Force. Now, when I was growing up, and perhaps when Leonard was growing up, but certainly in adolescence,
suggest that I'm older than most people here.
So am I. but, you know, we of the left, I think Leonard might slightly fall into that category. We thought of...
I'm a nonpartisan.
Oh, sorry, right.
Radio host.
Of course. But we thought of cops as pigs. Uh-huh. You know, that was the sort of late 60s, 70s. Increasingly, they became our friends. And after 9/11, every girl wanted to go out with a cop or a fireman. So the romance of the police, I was able to tap into that a little bit with my hero. It's like, did you see those firemen? They're so fabulous looking. Who knew?
My guests are Reggie Nadelson, whose latest novel is London Grad, published by Walker & Company, Lee Child, whose latest is Gone Tomorrow from Delacorte, and George Dawes Green, whose new novel is Ravens from Grand Central. We're talking about mystery novels set in New York, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with a conversation from last August with three crime writers, Lee Child, George Dawes Green, and Reggie Nadelson. They were on the show back in August to discuss crime fiction set in New York City, and we are re-airing that conversation for you on this long holiday weekend. I asked them, when you're writing about the city, are you writing for people who live here or those who will never set foot in the place?
Oh, pretty much those who will never set foot in the place. I mean, that's true, I think, wherever you're writing. If you've got a national or global audience in mind, there's only a very small percentage actually live in the place that you're writing about.
Well, there are people who, writers, who want to get everything exactly right. But I remember talking to Martin Amis about setting, and he said, you know, he really doesn't go back to Camden Town to see if the fish and chip store shop is next to the pharmacy. Or the chemist, as you people say in Britain, because it doesn't really matter. In movies, sometimes New Yorkers get very upset when a person turns a corner in Greenwich Village and is on 42nd Street. Does it bother you, George?
It bothered me a little bit when they made a movie of Caveman's Valentine and they shot it all in Toronto. because, you know, New York City was such a character.
You know, when the Canadian dollar became stronger than the U.S. dollar. Right. I was hoping that they would use New York as a as a replacement for films about Toronto.
I somehow think that that's not going to happen. Canadians really care about Toronto, and they really want Toronto to be right. I'm absolutely joking. I don't think Canadians.
But it did look strange to you because you probably had a New York in your head.
Well, they also have to take out so much. You know, they just the neighborhoods are kind of bland. And
I was going to say Toronto is the worst, and you can see it. You wait for the credits, and you start seeing what look like rather Canadian names, and you know that's why it's wrong. Toronto really doesn't look at all like New York, and they'd be better off to shoot it on a stage and leave out the exteriors, because you get that weird fake feeling that you do in a lot of digital stuff. Yeah. You know, the Roman Stadium is now full of 9 million people, but they're not real.
But what about your Brighton Beach? Do you make sure that it is exactly accurate?
Half and half. I mean, I like to go back and look. I'm certainly not. Somebody said, oh, you must know Brighton. I mean, my favorite quote is Elmore Leonard. Somebody said, do you know all those lowlife and you hang out in those bars and you do all, he just said, I write fiction. And I think that's the most important thing, is to make people believe it. I like to go around, partly because I learn new parts of the city. I have one book in which I've completely invented a restaurant, but it's in a very specific place. I'm now doing one set on Sugar Hill in Harlem. And so I go around and I kind of identify where it would be, and then I mix it up. But for me, it's just for the fun of getting it right.
Well, Lee, in Gone Tomorrow, you give us the exact specifications of a subway car. Is that something that you could just Google and get the information about?
Yeah, that's what I did. It was at the beginning of the book, and it was just one of those paragraphs that needed sort of meat. You know, it needed some facts in it. So I just Googled MTA and just pretty much cut and paste, and it was just right for that particular part. But it's always much more about being convincing than being accurate.
Well, in the hard way, you tell us how long it takes to walk from a specific fire plug on 6th Avenue to West Broadway and Spring Street, and how many traffic lights there are between West 72nd Street and Houston Street.
Yeah, but that's a good case in point. I mean, I base a lot of things on a memory I have from when I worked in television when we made a Maigret series. Remember Inspector Maigret, old-time Paris? We shot it in Prague because Prague actually looked more like Paris than Paris did for the purpose of that show. And that's a lesson that you got to apply. Actually, the hard way that you mentioned was an interesting book from that point of view, because at one point, there's a lot of stuff on the Upper West Side and a lot of stuff in the West Village. And getting from one to the other, it was just beginning to sound like a kind of demented MapQuest page on acid. So I said, you know, I'm not going to be accurate. People know the rough, basic outline of Manhattan. So I had people doing things that were actually not possible, driving the wrong way on Houston Street and so on, simply because to avoid it was just silly. And so for 99.9% of the audience, that works fine. Somebody who lives possibly in the West Village is going to say, wait a minute, you can't do that. But it's all about percentages. If you can convince 99.9% of the people, you're doing a pretty good job.
George, you have Romulus visit an East Village squat. I don't know if there are squats in the East Village anymore.
No, that was, again, that's all back in the early 90s. That was a squat that I was describing from life, a squat that I'd spent time in. And I spent time, you know, in Tompkins Square Park, out in the tent village then that Giuliani later dismantled.
What were you doing there? I mean, my life
was in disarray. So I was spending a lot of time out there. And then, You know, then when I wrote it, I used a tremendous amount of specificity in certain cases. People who read novels don't realize that the specificity doesn't mean that this isn't pure imagination. So a lot of times I'd be very, very specific. I remember one of my characters pointing across the river at the site where Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr had their duel, and it actually was, you know, miles and miles away. But that, but being absolutely specific does something within the world of the novel that's completely important. But it doesn't mean that we're not lying.
I agree. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the feeling. I'm rereading Another Country because I wanted to read up on what jazz was like in Harlem in the Village in those days, which is such an amazing book, and I'd forgotten, really. But Baldwin very rarely gives you specific streets. There's very little description of what the characters look like, and yet you can live in this. Of course, he's a genius, which helps, but it's still, I think the specificity is, you know, I think Graham Greene said, you know, the more specific, the more universal, we share our dreams, which is my favorite line. And I think that's true. If the specifics are there for you and they're there for the reader, on the other hand, the thing about getting the streets going the wrong way, only your best friend will say, you had the cars going the wrong way on 10th Avenue. Is that all you read?
I mean, did you go to the various clubs and cafes that Artie goes to?
Yes, and some of them are made up. Some of them are, I mean, there's a big one in this book, which is called Pravda 2, because his friend wanted a club called Pravda, but Keith McNally already had one. So the joke is Pravda 2.
You have a scene with cops working as consultants on a TV cop show. Law and Order and CSI probably have changed the way that people read.
They do.
The sorts of books that you people write.
They've also changed the way cops behave. I mean, I have some detective friends who said, now you can't, younger cops often base their behavior a little bit on what the good cop shows are like. Just like apparently the mafia used to use The Godfather as a training film.
Well, actually, all mobsters think of The Godfather as their great icon. When I was working on a movie for Miramax about the Russian mafia, and so I was interviewing the mobsters down in Brighton Beach, spending lots of time with them, and all of them are trying to base their life on a movie, and that is again.
But are you talking about the Russian mafia?
Yeah, the Russian mafia.
MIFIYA.
they want to be just like, the Godfather, mafioteers. And this is the great thing about New York City. You go through New York City, and when you're talking to any kind of low level criminal, he has dreams of being a star. And he usually knows a few movie stars, you know, because the movie stars want, you know, they want to get authenticity, so they, you know, they're hanging out with him, and it's always this strange confluence between Hollywood and the streets.
Absolutely, I think you could do a great book with the hero who's a cop who becomes a consultant, and then has to do detecting through the movie world.
My guests are Reggie Nadelson, whose latest is London Grad, published by Walker & Company. George Dawes Green, his new novel is Ravens from Grand Central. And Lee Child, whose latest is Gone Tomorrow from Delacorte. The NYPD is in all of your novels. And do you hang out with them? Somebody like Richard Price definitely would spend a lot of time with the cops and spend a lot of time on the corner with the people he's writing about.
I don't, actually. I don't do much specific research at all for a book. I mean, I do know plenty of cops in many different cities, actually, and FBI people and so on, just because those are the type of people you meet when you become a crime writer. You meet them for different reasons. But I prefer to live in my imagination. You know, I don't necessarily need to go for a ride along with a cop to be able to figure out what their day is like, necessarily. And I worry a little bit about the search for authenticity overwhelming imagination. I think it's easily possible to do too much research. Research needs to be like an iceberg where 95% of it is discarded. And I think it's pretty easy to tell books where the writer has done a lot of research and is either unwilling or not yet ready to give up the inessential parts. And you're reading between the lines. You know, the author is saying, look, I did this research, damn it, I'm going to put it in.
This is the same sort of thing as we were talking about earlier, whether you're going the wrong way up 10th Avenue. Cops have always told me that that TV shows about cops are absolutely ridiculous because, you know, life isn't that stressed all the time. In fact, they always like the comedies about cops the best because they said they always came closest. In the end, you have to create something that is exciting to read, don't you?
That works both ways, though, because CSI apparently is having effect on juries. You know, I hear from prosecutors that convictions are harder to get now because the standard real-world type of evidence that they can present is not good enough for a jury that's been raised on CSI. They expect 100% certainty at every point.
George, your novel, The Juror, was based on a mob trial, wasn't it? Or is about a mob trial?
Yeah, it's about a mob trial.
How accurate would that be?
Well, you know, I don't know.
Or was the movie more accurate than the book?
No. Hollywood movies are never more accurate. But I did spend a lot of time when we were making the movie talking to some of the mobsters who were hired as extras. And, you know,
they hire mobsters as extras, absolutely, to make sure that they look authentic?
No, but, you know, that's how some of these mobsters make a living, you know, as extras in movies. And, you know, it's always fun because then they're always having arguments about, oh, this isn't authentic. Oh, this wouldn't work. Oh, this would work. So, yeah, that's always fun.
I think it depends what kind of book you're writing. If you're writing a great police procedural like a Joseph Wamba, you do need to know. If you're writing, I suspect, more the kinds of things we write. I mean, I met a detective when I started. I found a detective because I was so worried, A, being a woman, B, never having seen a gun in my life and coming from a culture that loathes guns, that I wouldn't be able to do it. So I find this wonderful detective, and he takes me in his car, and I said to him, "Do you have a gun?" He said, "I'm a cop." I said, "Can I see it?" He said, "Okay." He said, "But don't pick it up like dirty Kleenex. You have to hold the gun." And so I think he reassured me. He said, "Listen, there are 50,000 people in law enforcement in New York City. We have everything. There's nothing you can write. If you make it believable, it exists. There's apparently one guy who has a PhD in classics. There's nothing that doesn't exist in New York City."
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, and I do go on ride-alongs. I always find something on a ride-along that I can use. I understand Lee's point about researching too much. But I usually find something, and it usually is something that inspires a character. I tend to do my research after I've written the first draft, and then I'll go back, and then I'll go on the ride along, and they always want to tell you about thrilling things that they've done, and you're not interested in that. What you really want to know is how do you pick up a gun, or really how do you deal with the boredom?
But the cops want to be the subject of your next book.
Absolutely, yeah, and they really want to be able to choose who plays them in the movie.
But on the other hand, you mentioned Mystery Writers of America, the New York chapter. A lot of those writers are cops. You know, that's their day job. There's a bunch of them that are cops by day, writers by night. And they tell me that they can't use a lot of the real stuff. A lot of the real stuff is, as George said, it's too spread out. You know, weeks of boredom and then maybe some brief activity. Or just too appalling, too horrible, too sordid, unbelievably bad stuff, so that if they did write it, the reader would say, well, that's just totally made up. So they're in the strange position of having to ignore their reality and make stuff up that is actually more palatable than their day job.
There have been many wonderful detective novels set in New York City, from Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe, who grows orchids and never leaves his house on West 35th Street, to Lawrence Block's Bernie Rodenbaugh, who's a bookstore owner and gentleman thief. Do you have favorite New York crime writers?
I grew up on Rex Stout. I mean, I love Nero Wolfe. And you know what's interesting to me? It seems to me that Nero Wolfe must be Tom Harris's inspiration for Hannibal Lecter. I mean, it's another epicure who's really a hermit. You know, I'm sure Hannibal Lecter would grow orchids in his cell if they'd let him, and they'd probably... Will in the next book.
And love to cook as well.
But there was something just incredibly beautiful about him having this great distance from all of the crimes that he was supposedly pursuing.
We have 15 seconds left. Do you want to give us a name, Lee, or doesn't it matter?
I'd go with Nero Wolfe, too, in the sense that he's New York's Sherlock Holmes, you know, almost to the type of neighborhood.
I think I'd go with Nero Wolfe, too, I'm afraid, which is, makes us all pretty unoriginal, but right.
And I want to thank you all for being with us. Reggie Nadelson, whose latest book is London Grad, published by Walker & Company. Lee Child, whose latest is Gone Tomorrow from Delacorte. And George Dawes Green, whose latest novel is Ravens. It's from Grand Central. And I assume there are other books in the works, and we'll be seeing you again. And I thank you so much for being with us today on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, I'll be conducting my annual Christmas gospel music special, playing classic recordings you're not likely to hear anywhere else. And then Marcel Theroux on his novel Far North, one of this year's National Book Award finalists, plus a look at why some buildings work and others don't with Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Julie Corcoran, Blakeney Schick, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Andrea Maraskin, Angela Sheldon, and Barbara Kahn. Michael Lupica was at the audio control. So I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas Eve, and we will see you tomorrow on Christmas Day.